sport is a crucible of intensity. Emotions run high and the stakes are often even higher. The Olympic Games are rare. Nowhere else do the lights shine brighter. The opportunities for glory are few and far between. Therefore, every moment counts for so much. Even just getting to them can be enough. The drive to succeed can sometimes be overwhelming. Is it possible to want it too much? So much so that it clouds judgment and alters behaviors. Desperation, fierce desire, jealousy, resentment, and ambition are powerful forces. They can push individuals to act in ways that are unexpected, unfortunate, and sometimes deeply regrettable. The pursuit of excellence, whilst admirable, is not without its darker side. When the prospect of achievement becomes all-consuming, it can snowball and spiral out of control. As in life, the quest for glory can reveal both the best and worst in people. You can want it too much. This is the Winter Olympic Series on the Sporting Almanac podcast.
Figure skating.
Not a sport I'm particularly au fait with. How about you?
No, I mean, I've watched it a few times. I think the British consciousness is very, very heavily focused on Torval and Dean for this one. Historically, of course. The Great Britain do not win many Winter Olympic gold medals, so we do tend to celebrate our gold medalists.
We revere them.
Often for more than 40 years after the fact in this case. But yeah, I mean, it's a good sport. It's fun. It's exciting. It's basically like dancing, but with a element of terrifying danger and sharp blades involved. So,
yeah, that's actually not a terrible summary. It is kind of like dancing on ice, which is, I guess, why there is a show named as such. Yeah, but it's figure skates are not normal ice skates. Did you know that?
No, but you can tell me.
There are slightly visible differences between a figure skate and an ice hockey skate. Yeah, figure skates have got a set of large jagged teeth called toe picks at the front part of the blade. And they are used, there is a logic to this, they're used primarily for jumping and also to obviously assist in certain spins or moves or what have you. And the blade is curved, which helps spinning on a point, you know, when they like pirouette, that helps that particular skill. So yeah, like maybe actually we said it's a bit like dancing. Maybe a more comparable sport is gymnastics, like on the floor, like not obviously.
Yeah,
not,
certainly in Olympic terms. Yeah,
not like the rings or the parallel bars, because that would be insane. But it's like it is a bit like the floor gymnastics.
That would be dangerous to do in skates.
Yeah, no flips or cartwheels, but there are spins, jumps, pirouettes, so on and so forth. So
yeah.
Do you know how it's sort of not assessed, because obviously I know we don't really understand the scoring system, but do you know anything about like the elements, the moves, so to speak?
I know there's certain elements they have to do. They have to do certain things during a competition to make sure it is well balanced, their performance, like jumps, jump combinations, spins, step sequences, choreographic sequences.
Yeah. I looked this up. Like this is not within my knowledge, I will confess. I looked it up, and some of them are sort of in the vernacular, like I was familiar with them when I heard or read them, but there are many that aren't. And like the jumps include the axel, and I think that's the famous one. I think most people have probably heard of an axel jump.
It is, yeah.
There's a lutz, a flip, a loop, a salchow, which is a great name, and a toe jump. And then you've also got the half loop, the half flip, the wally jump, the waltz jump, the stag jump, and the split jump. You probably just
wally jump's good. I like that.
Yeah, just gonna have to go on the internet, guys, if you want to see what they look like, because I don't fully understand, and I certainly can't.
I don't think I've got the vernacular to describe them.
Yeah, that's it. I don't think I could describe them with sufficient justice. So yeah, that's the jumps. The spins include the camel vertical, like straight up in the air. The sit leg out, which I think everybody would recognise. The upright, the layback, which is apparently a more extreme Beelman. The death drop,
which is very aptly named. And then and the Beelman, again, is another one I think people would recognize. That's the one where they pull their leg up behind their head when they're stood up and hold on to it and spin.
Yes.
Or the lay, and I think the layback is that move, but you lean backwards.
Yeah. So that, now you say all these, I sort of do recognize them in my own mind. I probably could, from your description there, point them out if I see them. But yeah, I mean, this is, it's an immensely technical sport. It's obviously immensely risky sport. There's a lot of risk there in terms of injury. It's a very elegant sport as well when it's done properly.
Very elegant, mate. The turns. Do you want to know some of the turns names?
Of course.
The three turn, the bracket, the mohawk, the rocker, the counter and the twizzle. And then apparently Choctaws are two-footed equivalents of rockers and counters, whatever they are.
Of course, yes.
And then you got a couple of other moves outside of the mainstream here, which people will enjoy because one of them's called the spread eagle.
Nice.
And then there's a hydroplaning, a spiral, and an Ina Bauer, which I presume is named after the figure skater who did the Ina Bauer first.
Probably Ina Bauer, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's it in a nutshell. And you get a score according to the base value and grade of execution, resulting in a combined technical element score. So it's a bit like diving.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
That's it. That's figure skating. But we want to tell a story about figure skating because stories are what engage people, Jack.
Yeah. And we've told a lot of stories about heroism so far in this series. A lot of people continuing through adversity and eventually getting their just reward for their efforts and their dedication to the cause and everything else. This is not one of those stories.
This is the opposite end of the spectrum.
For every yin, there's a yang.
That's it. It's like, how do we say it in the intro? I think it's just basically like, can you want it too much? You know?
Yeah. This is a story of Tonya Harding. Very famous story. It'll certainly be very familiar to American listeners out there, but and also to anyone who's watched the film, I, Tonya, which was released, I think, 7 or 8 years ago now. Very famous story. Time for us to tell it.
Yeah, time for us to tell it. Do you want to take the lead? Do you want to tell us about Tonya herself? And then maybe I'll do Nancy Kerrigan for us. To complete the picture.
Yeah, Tonya Harding, obviously played by Margot Robbie in the film, for those who've seen it. That'll give you an impression of who we're talking about. She was born in Portland, Oregon. She was raised by her mother and father, who enrolled her in ice skating lessons when she was just 3 years old. So again, just like many before her, she was doing this from a very young age. She spent much of her early life training. She actually dropped out of high school in the end to devote more time to her sport. It was her life, it is fair to say. During her youth, her father held sort of various odd jobs. He managed apartments, he drove a truck, he worked at a bait and tackle store. He was often unemployed, though, due to poor health. Lavona, her mother, struggled to support the family while working as a waitress and often had to hand sew her daughter's skating costumes to save money. However, she also claimed, Harding later, that she was frequently abused by her mother. She stated by the time she was 7 years old that physical and psychological abuse had become a regular part of her life. She'd also written about being the victim of sexual violence from her half-brother, who was eventually sent to prison for sexually harassing her. So a astonishing childhood, really, in terms of so against the grain and unimaginable.
A rough upbringing, right? Like, yeah.
Where with skating as sort of the one constant in her life. Because she was very good, obviously. Of course she was very good. We wouldn't be telling this story about her if she wasn't. She came sixth at the 1986 US Figure Skating Championships, improved to fifth in 1987 and 88, and then third in 1989. So she went into 1990 as a favourite, but she was unwell and she ended up coming seventh. But 1991 was her breakthrough year, when at the US Championships she completed her first triple axel in the competition on February the 16th and became the first American woman to do so at that point. She ended up winning the silver medal that year in 1991, with Christy Yamaguchi taking the gold. A certain Nancy Kerrigan taking bronze in that as part of the first ever sweep of the women's podium by a single country at the World Championships that year. This was the last time she landed the triple axel because after that her performance started to decline. She placed third at the 1992 US Figure Skating Championships despite twisting her ankle during practice. Notable performance still. She ended up coming fourth in the February 1992 Winter Olympics and sixth at the 1992 World Championships. So she was there or thereabouts constantly, but never quite able to get over the line. And it was at this point that she started to miss out on events too because she didn't qualify at all for the 1993 World Championships. Yeah. So yeah, a difficult period in her life, just to sort of set the story for what comes next, and hand over to you to talk about the other protagonist of this story.
Yeah, well, that's it. This is famously a rivalry between two women, and the other woman in this story is Nancy Kerrigan. And she was born in Stoneham in Massachusetts, the youngest child and only daughter of a welder, a chap called Daniel, and a homemaker, Brenda. And she had brothers, Michael and Mark, and they played ice hockey. But she took up figure skating at the age of 6. Didn't start private lessons until she was 8 and won her first competition, the Boston Open, age 9. So a bit of a prodigy. Got a bit of the Shaun Whites about her in that sense. Like just very, very good. And so despite the way that she's being portrayed, actually, her family were like from quite modest means. I think the way this story has been told over the years is sort of like, you know, like the rough, hard upbringing versus sort of like the prim and proper, well, affluent family.
There's no doubt the former is true in Harding's case, but yeah.
Yeah, well, this is it, but like it's definitely been exaggerated because, like, for example, Kerrigan's dad worked 3 jobs just to fund her skating career. He also drove the Zaboni at the local rink track. Yeah, in exchange for lessons. And the Zaboni is, do you want to explain it? Because I don't know if I can do this machine justice.
So if you've been to an ice hockey game or if you've been to a skating rink, even a Zamboni is the basically big ride on tractor kind of thing that sort of heats and flattens the ice in front of you, basically smooths the ice down in between hard skating, which obviously cuts it up a lot, so it removes all the grooves and cuts on top of the ice, creates sort of a layer of water on it to flatten it out, and then obviously that then freezes and you have a lovely smooth surface. So yeah, can't have an ice rink without a Zamboni.
And so her dad drove that to get lessons for Nancy. And she sort of began to reach prominence at the national level when she came 4th in the 1987 US Figure Skating Championships. I think she was building a reputation for being quite a strong jumper.
Yeah.
And then she made her senior debut the following season, 1988, moving up the national rankings each year. Sorry, I should have said her 4th place finish was in the junior US Figure Skating Championships.
Yes.
And then in 88, she went to the seniors. She finished 12th in 88, 5th in 89, and then she won the bronze medal in 1989. Sorry, let me get 5th in 89. And then she won a bronze medal in one of the circuit events, I think. And then she came 4th in 1990 in the US Championships. So, yeah, like a steady trajectory towards the top. And then she came 3rd in 1991, and then she qualified for the 1991 World Figure Skating Championships, where she won the bronze medal. Her medal, as you've already mentioned, being part of that first ever sweep, with Harding getting the silver and Yamaguchi getting the gold. And then 1992, Kerrigan again improved on her placement at the previous national championships and finished 2nd. And then she went to the 1992 Winter Olympics, where she won a bronze medal, Yamaguchi taking the gold there as well. And then she got silver at 1992 World Championships. So she'd just gone past Harding, basically.
Yes.
And at the same time as Harding was seeing like a quite a significant drop off in her form, maybe Kerrigan was sort of on an upward trajectory. Although it's fair to say that in 1993, a bit like Harding, she had a dip in form. So both women in the lead up to 1994 and the Winter Olympics at Lillehammer were sort of in a position where it could go either way for them. It's probably
under a lot of pressure, like probably quite a career defining year they felt heading into 1994 and the Winter Olympics. Obviously the Winter Olympics had been in 1992, then they moved to the off cycle. It used to be in the same year as the Summer Olympics. From 1994, they moved the Winter Olympics forward 2 years, so it's then in off 2 year cycles as it remains to this day.
Yeah.
So had a second bite of the cherry only 2 years later, a short Olympic cycle. So big year for both of them and for a lot of winter athletes, of course.
Very big year. And a couple of other important things for people to understand. So Christy Yamaguchi had now retired, and she
Which
was
a big deal. Yeah,
a big deal. Yeah, so a reigning Olympic champ had retired, so you know there's a shot here at winning it all. And the other thing that's really interesting is that Americans are absolutely barbaric when it comes to their selection process. They are
in every sport, yeah.
Utterly ruthless. You go to the US Championships and you have to qualify. It doesn't matter what your form's like outside of the US Championships. It's essentially knockout qualification, and only the top two qualify for the Olympic Games. And there was another young upstart on the scene, a lady called Michelle Kwan, who is a super interesting woman.
Very famous woman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She would go on, to put this, to give everyone like a flavor of the competition levels, she would go on to be a two-time Olympic medalist, a five-time world champ, a nine-time US champ, national champ, that is, and weirdly, the former United States ambassador to Belize under the Biden administration. So,
obviously,
even though Yamaguchi's gone and Kwan has come onto the scene, both women are, you know, not guaranteed of their place at Lillehammer.
Indeed, yeah. As we say, pressure was high. Both of them under pressure to perform to get that final place, both competing against each other for that. So, in the lead up to the US Championships on the afternoon of January the 6th, 1994, Kerrigan was practicing for those championships on an ice rink inside the Cobo Arena. A camera crew was there. They were recording her practice session in order to make a documentary about her. They captured her leaving the ice rink and walking through a curtain and down a hallway. The camera crew then cuts out. A man was stood behind the camera crew. As soon as they stopped filming, he went behind the same curtain. He followed Kerrigan down the hallway. He approached Kerrigan from behind, extended a telescopic baton, the kind of police baton.
Like an asp.
Yes, exactly. And he struck her lower right thigh and walked away. He then escaped from the arena by smashing through a locked glass door and out onto the street, where a car was waiting to act as a getaway vehicle for him. The camera crew obviously heard the commotion. They began recording again shortly after, and they found Kerrigan sitting on the floor, crying, of course, surrounded by arena staff. Kerrigan then exclaimed through tears what became an incredibly famous line, why? She was then carried away to the changing room by her father.
It's actually like heartbreaking, that clip, because you can,
it
you
is
can hear
so bad.
Like you can just hear the pain and like the worry.
True anguish, yeah.
Yeah, like the heartbreak is the way to put it. Like she thought at that point that potentially she had like a career-ending injury or something.
Yeah, I mean, as well as the pain, obviously.
Yeah.
The pain would be severe, the shock would be severe, probably the trauma, because, I mean, someone attacks you like that.
Randomly.
You assume, yeah, randomly out of the blue with no warning, you probably assume more is to come. And, yeah, I can't even imagine the amount of things must have been going through her head, yeah. And, of course, it was right before the US Championships, which was so essential to her career, so essential to her qualification for the Olympics and everything else. So nothing was broken in the attack. There were no broken bones.
Which is lucky,
yeah, of course. But there was severe bruising to Kerrigan's knee and a quadricep tendon as well, and that did force her to withdraw from the US Championships. So it was very severe result of that.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, as far as you can, that's Olympic dream dead.
Yeah.
You know, like,
in an instant.
Yeah, exactly. And then like, a completely unprovoked attack, no explanation or rhyme or reason to it. And
a complete stranger as well.
As you might imagine, Jack, the people, everyone, the media, other competitors, and most importantly, the Federal Bureau of Investigation the FBI started asking, why the hell would someone do that and who stands to benefit?
Yeah.
So.
Because what happened in the meantime?
Yeah, so an investigation begins, but the US Championships roll on. The show must go on.
They do, of course.
And Tonya Harding wins it. She returns to form, and along with Michelle Kwan, the aforementioned Michelle Kwan, they both come in the top two, and those two are going to the Olympics. That's the decision. That's how the Americans operate. However, the US Olympic Committee decided to make an exception, which is very rare.
Very rare indeed, yeah.
They don't normally do so, but because of the circumstances, they decided to effectively reserve a spot for Kerrigan, which is really quite unfair on Michelle Kwan because she came second. It was agreed that she would effectively travel as a sub. And if Kerrigan was able to compete, then she would be going to the Olympic Games. So all not necessarily lost.
However,
when they made that decision, when they made
they that, didn't realize
they did
at that
not,
point, yeah.
No, that the FBI, the agents, had already begun to become extremely suspicious of Miss Harding and her team.
Indeed, yeah.
where does it go next?
Yeah, Tonya Harding. She'd been in a long-term, very volatile, very abusive on and off relationship with a man named Jeff Galluli. It was him who planned the attack. So Galluli had conspired with another man, a friend of his and Harding, a man named Sean Eckhart. They had hired a man named Shane Stant, who was the one who actually attacked Kerrigan, and his uncle Derek Smith, who was the getaway driver, to carry out the attack. So Tonya Harding was questioned on this. Initially, she denied any involvement. In the meantime, the Olympics went ahead between the 13th and 25th of February 1994. Kerrigan had recovered by this point. She did compete in that alongside Tonya Harding. Both women skated at the Games. Kerrigan got a medal. She got the silver medal in the end, and Harding finished down in 8th. Michelle Kwan, unfortunately, and undeservedly, of course, she did not compete in that, although she would have her day in the future.
Mm.
So despite having previously denied prior knowledge of the attack after the Olympics, in March, Tonya Harding pled guilty as part of a plea deal to conspiracy to hinder a prosecution and of having knowledge of the fact of the attack after the fact, essentially. So basically that she knew after the fact who had done it and why it had been done, but she failed to tell prosecutors, and that's what she got charged with.
Yeah, they have weird laws about that in America. Like,
yes,
if you can be done for knowledge after the fact in a way that you don't get done for in like in the UK.
Yeah,
it's almost like a duty to disclose is probably a good way of putting it.
Indeed, yeah. So it's not like perjury in the sense that she's not been asked under oath
and lied,
and that she's not lied under oath, and she's just failed to disclose.
Yeah, and it's not perverting the course of justice in the fact that she didn't necessarily. Well, in this instance, she was done for conspiracy to hinder a prosecution, but the knowledge after the fact bit, if she had just known and not done anything over in the UK, there would be no reprisals for that. But I think the States is a bit different.
Yeah. However, both Galluli and Eckhart are both on record as saying Harding had prior knowledge of the attack and was complicit in it. So if you've got any sympathy for her right now, maybe that needs to fade just a little bit.
Yeah, because there is pretty compelling evidence actually that she knew beforehand. Without smearing her character, I don't have access to the file or all of the evidence. I can't say with any degree of certainty. She's obviously taken a plea deal, and that is what she stands convicted of, nothing else. But the allegation, if there is one, about her knowledge before the incident, so to speak, is that she obtained details of Kerrigan's training session from a lady called Vera Morano, who is a Pennsylvanian figure skating writer who'd basically obtained details from the United States Figure Skating Association and then provided the location to Harding of where Kerrigan would be training. And like, Morano has no reason to say otherwise, you know? Like, maybe she does actually. I don't know the relationship between the two women, but on the face of things, is corroborated essentially by an independent witness who says, I am the person who provided the information about the training session. The reason that's relevant is because I think that Kerrigan was training somewhere other than her normal place in the lead up to the US Championship, so it wouldn't necessarily have been known. And then also the other thing that's interesting is that the conspirators knew that Kerrigan's landing leg was her right leg,
yeah,
and that would be the best way to injure her. And these guys were, you know, yeah, sure, one of them was in a relationship with Tonya Harding, but like, they didn't necessarily know what they needed to know about the technical aspects of figure skating. They were dummies, I think is the right phrase.
Yes, which is a huge part of this in terms of the accusations against her. Obviously not found guilty in a court of law of these, but those are the accusations against her.
It's probably worth mentioning, just so that it doesn't look like we're slandering her for no reason, The US Figure Skating Association conducted its own investigation. They convened a disciplinary panel, and they concluded, albeit to a civil standard rather than a criminal standard, that she did have prior knowledge. And so they stripped her of the 1994 US Championship title and banned her from life from participating in any US Figure Skating Association events, either as a skater or a coach.
Yeah. Just to be clear, the civil standard is the balance of probability rather than a criminal standard, obviously, which would be beyond reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
So it's a lower level of certainty on that. On the balance of probability.
More likely than not, rather than you being sure. So yeah, like a pretty sorry story, but an infamous one. And like a little bit tragic, really. I mean, it's kind of good that Kerrigan still had her day in the sun and got that Olympic medal and it didn't actually cost her. But like,
And she was under intense media pressure, obviously, in the light of this, and intense pressure on herself as well in terms of the competition. It is very notable. She did superbly well to get a silver medal in that at the highest level of the sport. It is entirely to Nancy Kerrigan's credit there, of course.
Yeah, for sure. And it was an absolute circus when it came out that Harding and her affiliates were involved.
It was captured partly on camera as well. It's everything the US media thrives off, isn't it? It's got every aspect to it. They would absolutely want to milk someone crying on the floor, shouting why, and the footage that went along with it, and the scandal that went along with it, and then the FBI investigation and everything. It was a huge media story, and it was, yeah, referenced by everyone.
Yeah,
Saturday Night Live making references, and it was a huge deal at the time.
Yeah, it was
up there with the OJ trial in the mid-90s.
It dominated the build-up to the Olympic Games, and then obviously there was a huge fallout afterwards. It's just a very good example of, like, the desperate length some people are prepared to go to.
Yeah.
To achieve...
the dark side of elite sport, yeah.
Yeah, like you know, like, there's wanting to win, and then there's wanting to win at all costs. And, you know, in a sporting frame, that is usually sort of discussed through the sort of cheating in the rules, anti-doping, so on and so forth. It's not usually trying to, like, maim or injure your competitors so that they can't go up against you.
No,
it's pretty sinister stuff, but it's gone down in infamy. It is one of those great Winter Olympic stories. It will be told forever. We've probably done it a disservice because we've rattled through it in just half an hour, but...
Yeah. But I mean, as we say, there's film made about it as well. I, Tonya, a few years ago, Margot Robbie as Tonya Harding and Caitlin Carver as Nancy Kerrigan. So I believe that was well received. So go and feast your eyes upon that. That'll tell you a bit more. And there's plenty of other sources that'll go into greater depth on this story. It was a huge deal.
Yeah, yeah. If you like true crime and you like sport, here they are merging.
I think there is a Netflix documentary as well.
I've
not seen it, but I haven't seen it. We should have watched that, really. Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll watch it after.
But
yeah, like, I guess the other thing that adds to the sort of, I don't know, like, what's the right word? Like, the Hollywood aspect to this is that neither woman competed in another Olympic Games. This is, I guess that kind of adds to it all, really. Just makes it a little bit more pointed in terms of a story.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, figure skating, scandals. Not corruption, not doping, not cheating within the rules, just straight up criminality.
Very few stories like that in the history of sport, really, at that higher level, relatively speaking. And as we say, another reason why it is so well remembered.
Yeah.
As well as the media hype and everything that went along with it.
From the lows, Jack, to the highs. Our next episode, the bobsleigh.
Ah, my word. everyone knows what we're going to talk about. Anyone who's our age and has watched films, for example, watched particular comedy films from the mid-90s, will know what we're talking about. But it's a story that, yeah, you'll hear. It's great.
And you'll know. If you like sport, you'll know. But we're also going to... It might be a little bit longer the next episode. These have been like 20 minutes to half an hour. The next one could stretch to about 45 minutes. We'll see. We'll see how we get on and how succinct we can keep ourselves. But we're just going to add in a little second course to do with a war hero. So
yeah, why not?
Yeah, bobsleigh. Yeah, come back if you're interested.
Indeed. So until then.
Until then. See you in a bit, mate.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for joining us for our Winter Olympic series. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please tell a friend about it. We'll be covering everything from speed skating to snowboarding, from ice hockey to figure skating, and much more. There really is something for everyone. Once you've done that, please give us a like, a subscribe, a share or a comment, and tune in for the rest of the series or for one of our 40-odd other episodes on the sporting world as well. Our theme tune is Oh Yeah by Harmony Productions. You can find us on Blue Sky and Instagram at The Sporting Almanac. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the games as much as we certainly will. From both of us, goodbye for now.